is running up $5,000-$10,000 defense cost. I have a case pending right now. It happens to be in the state of Nevada, but Nevada has the same rules as we have that I'd like to see it get rid of. I represent a little electric cooperative. We built, or it built, some power lines, built about 70 miles of power lines, and hired an engineer. And the engineer was supposed to draw plans and specifications and supervise the job and inspect everything and make sure that it was done. Well, we ended up with a bunch of faulty cross arms, and a couple of years after the line was built, started dropping 115,000 bolts in the ground here and there when the cross arm had shed, so we sued the engineer. And he had sole contract with us. And it should have been under the old system. We would have had a lawsuit against him. And if we won, then maybe he had a right to go after somebody else for indemnity or contribution. But no, he immediately filed a third-party complaint against the inspection service that we didn't even know was involved, that he had hired to look at the cross arms. He filed a third-party complaint against the contractor claiming that the contractor had furnished the faulty materials. He filed a third-party complaint against two suppliers of the cross arms and against two manufacturers of the cross arms. So all of a sudden, instead of two lawyers and two defendants, we had six defendants and seven lawyers. And we go on and on and on. And then the horrible part of it is, if we lose the initial case against the engineer, all of that is for naught. Under the old system, the defendant, if somebody else was partially at fault or completely at fault, the defendant could put the other party on notice that if I lose this case, then I'm going to sue you. But now we bring the whole kit and caboodle in and we just spend money hand over fist. The defense cost, I would like to know what total defense costs are in the industry as a whole, but for some reason the insurance industry didn't see fit to give that to the task force, even though they were asked for it many times. And but I read just the other day that somebody made a study of the actual cases tried in the Tri-County area, Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties, I guess, and 53% of the cases were plaintiff's verdicts and 47% of them were defendant's verdicts. Now, if there's third-party complaints filed by every defendant in there, we know that 47% of them are moot. Now, there isn't third-party complaints filed in all of those cases, but for all of them that they are, it became moot after spending bokus of dollars. And I know what I'm saying is not popular. It's not popular with the defense lawyers, and for some reasons the insurance companies don't seem to like it. I don't know whether insurance companies believe in millions for defense and not a dime for retribution or what it is, but I think they're listening to their lawyers. And I hate to be, how many defense, yeah, there's someone sitting around here looking at me. But I blame we defense lawyers. I'm a member of the Oregon Association Defense Council, and I do a lot of defending for insurance carriers, but it just isn't fair. The legislature does not have the duty, I don't think, to provide full employment for lawyers. And if you do feel that way, you can always monkey at the workers' comp some more and put them to work there.
But St. Phillips has already had a turn at that.
But I feel very sincerely on this, and I have watched cases end up with $50,000, $60,000, $100,000 in defense costs that it should have been done for $10,000 or $15,000, and I can document it over and over. And it isn't all because of third-party practice. There's a bunch of other reasons in the procedure. I'd say that third-party practice is probably the largest single culprit as far as my practice going. And I file these third-party complaints, and I'm defending. You have to protect yourself from a malpractice case. You give somebody the tool to do it, and he monkeys with it, and he plays with it. You have to play with the system that's given to you to play with. And I really would urge this committee is doing everything within its power to take one giant step backwards, I guess, and save a whole bunch of money. And this is not going to be some vague promise of way down the road like everybody else has been giving you. I'll guarantee you this will make an immediate effect.
Yes. Excuse me, may we interrupt with a question? Representative Phillips.
Well, sir, you know, there's an easy answer to your question. See, if there weren't so many plaintiff's attorneys, we wouldn't need so many defense attorneys. I mean, that's the simple answer. And I say that almost in jest, but there was a RAND study that I remember seeing. It talked about plaintiff's costs being about 20% and defense costs about 18% of the... Or what, plaintiff's contingency fees accounting for 18%, that's what it was. And all defense costs, no. Contingency fees were 20%, defense costs were 18%. And I suppose if we cut third-party action out of that, we could even cut it down farther, is that what you're saying?
I haven't seen the RAND study on that aspect of it. I've read a lot of the RAND study. But I would bet you that that's too low for the state of Oregon. I'd just about bet anything. I don't know how you'd ever really get that study because you'd have to go ask every lawyer and every defense and every insurance carrier how much did that case cost you. There are no figures available in Oregon. But I think the insurance industry, if they would, could readily dig those figures up for you. As far as the defense cost. But I do know that Farmers Insurance Group for an 11-year period had 63% of the 63 cents. Now that percentage, I don't have a calculator and I'm not that good in my head, that'd be 100, whatever percentage 63 is of 163. Because they paid out 63 cents for every dollar paid out in claims. And I do have personal knowledge of a case where the verdict was $100,000 on a engineer's malpractice case, and defense costs were $63,000 in that case too.
Well, I have personal knowledge of a workers' comp case where defense fees were $68,000, the payout was zero, so I think we could all come up with some pretty gross examples too.
That's about the size of what I have to say on third-party practice. I would like to, while I'm here, touch on 323 a little bit. Does anybody have any more questions, or have I got you so muddled that...
Yeah. Why don't you go ahead, Mr. Gronza, with comments on 323.
And I'm certainly not prepared to make any in-depth study of it. I read the bill after I got to town at 4:30 this afternoon, but I'm not a complete stranger to it because we kicked most of this around in the task force. I should say first that on page 6, which is section 24, I believe is probably a pretty good piece of legislation, and I'm looking at it from the standpoint, and that has to do with officer and director's liability of nonprofit and volunteer organizations. They just can't get insurance. And it's similar to the Good Samaritan bills that we passed on the doctors and so forth. These people that are Rotary Club presidents and that sort of thing, or Strawberry Fair at Lebanon Rose Festival in Portland, are non-paid people, and it's getting to the point that we just can't get them to serve because we can't get insurance. And I think a different standard of care for them than the profit organization is probably a real good idea. On page 3, section 13, I have to really chortle at that. I don't know what the carriers are thinking about by trying to get in this mess on caps and economic damages versus non-economic damages. That's going to be another full employment bill for not only lawyers, but also economists. Now just take let me give you a case that I actually had. A 2-year-old boy who became a paraplegic. His back was broken right at the belt line. Terrific injuries. And we settled the case for a bundle of money. It didn't go to trial, but it settled on the eve of trial, so most of the money was spent that was going to be spent in the trial. Well, if you go in and try a case like that today under the system you have, you let the jury know that the doctors come in and talk, and you bring in rehabilitation experts and people that tell them what this boy's life is going to be like. And we break it down into special damages and general damages. Well, the special damages were his hospital bills. That's all he had up to then, and there wasn't very many hospital bills. Then the general damages, you throw it all in, his loss of income, and his pain and suffering and loss of enjoyment of life. Now, you change this around, so $500,000 is the most you can give that boy for the ruination of his life. Well, all the lawyer has to do is he hires a good economist. And that adds the plaintiff's lawyer hires an economist and the defense lawyer hires an economist. I don't know, it's going to get to be a real expertise in the battle of the experts, and you're going to have $5,000 or $10,000 additional on each side, and you're going to turn those things that we call general damages now into economic loss. The economist goes through this boy's history and gives him some IQ tests, and decides on what kind of an occupation he would have had he not been injured, and he turns that into loss of wages for the next 65 years. And it can be done. So all of a sudden, we're talking about economic loss instead of the old general damages. And the $500,000 or $100,000 cap doesn't mean a thing. It's just going to add to the cost. And I'm not really upset about this section, except that if we really want to do something to keep our insurance premiums down and contain the cost, is we've got to look at the cost of litigation. And I said you were listening a little bit earlier on the gentleman that talked about collateral source. And they said it was going to save a bunch of money. Well, I can look you people in the eyes and say that I've probably tried 300 cases plus. I've never really counted them. And I've probably settled 1,000 cases, and I've never had a case where your collateral source bill, as proposed, would have saved a nickel to the insurance carrier. Not one dime. Because the policies that Representative Dix was referring to, I don't think you can get a policy like that today. Every policy that I've seen has a subrogation clause in it. And Social Security, Medicare has subrogation clauses. Now there's one policy that I have seen that doesn't have a subrogation clause, and that's Blue Cross. But they get around it real easy. Their policy says that we don't pay if anybody else is liable. And so you go to Blue Cross, say, well, gee, this is on down the road a year or 2 years or 5 years, we want money. They say, okay, we'll pay you if you sign an agreement to pay us back out everything that pay us back as soon as you collect. So the policy doesn't have a subrogation clause in it, but you still pay it back before, because they make darn sure of it. And I agree with the, that if it is a true collateral source, but every example brought up isn't a true collateral source. If the person buys his own insurance, it came out of his pocket. If you have sick leave, according to a labor contract, you have so many days of sick leave a year accumulated. If you use them up and then you, next year you fall down the stairs in your own home, you don't have that sick leave because you've used your accumulated sick leave. And it just isn't going to save anything. It might be something nice to talk about, but if we really want to do something, let's look at the cost of how we're going about running this system. Another little thing that I thought about, somebody asked a real pointed question, do you believe in government regulation or should the marketplace take care of it? Well, it just depends on whose ox is being gored. I submit to you that all of us would like to have the guy we're dealing with across the table from us regulated, but leave me alone. That's utopia. Let's just kick out some of the regulations and some of the hoops and get back to some basic principles and save some real money.
What's in Dix? The committee wouldn't object. I'd like to hear from Mr. Lombard on the third party. I'd like you to stay right there.
Okay.
For the record, I'm Kip Lombard. Representative Dix, of course, that issue was in Senate Bill 325, is now in Senate Bill 222. You may or may not see it in that legislation. I can only report from, you know, what I think the majority of the group of people that I represent, and I'd like to emphasize that I do not represent the insurance companies in this matter, although I have asked a number of lawyers who do primarily insurance company defense work to come and testify on our behalf, and I do, you know, they express their opinions, which in many cases are consistent with ours. And I find that there's a real split of opinion among the defense bar as to whether or not to do away with third-party practice. I would say this, that the Council on Court Procedures over in the Senate testified against doing away with third-party practice. And most of the people, as I say, that have talked to me on the issue from, you know, from the defense side have said do not do away with it. So that's the position we take.
Who are these Council on Court Procedures? Are
Council on Court Procedures was created by the 1979 legislature with the purpose of, instead of having the legislature every session get a bunch of lawyers before it proposing to change the rules of civil procedure, to delegate that function to a group of professionals, a group of lawyers, let them battle it out among themselves, let them promulgate the rules, the changes to the rules and what have you, and then they submit those, as you know by now, to the legislature. If you want to change them, you can change them, but if you don't change them, then they become law. It was a decision that we made at that time to try to get out of the bit of constantly coming back and forth to the legislature, trying to argue these highly technical issues before the legislature, and let a majority of the members of the bar decide that in that fashion.
May I just add a little bit to that? This Picarooni issue, it was sometime before 1979, because I served the first 6 years on it, and it's been, but at any rate, the Council on Court Procedures is made up of one Supreme Court judge, one Court of Appeals judge, about four or five circuit judges, one non-lawyer member, and then a number of lawyers. Oh, and a college, one or two college professors. And I was on that thing when a lot of these things were passed, and I was in, I believe there was 22 votes, and usually those things passed about 10 to 9 because we didn't have everybody there. It was a close vote. And I submit to you that the college professors and the judges aren't dealing with it on a day-to-day basis. And you can point out where it's so much better to solve one case, solve all the issues at once, and there's a lot of theory that goes good on it, as long as you don't care how much it costs. And the councils and court procedures, and that vote, as I understand it, is still running just about the same. And again, I hate to be throwing stones at my brethren in the defense council, but and they don't all think that way, but I submit to you, if you get rid of motions for summary judgment in tort cases, third-party practice, you are going to find pretty tough pickings for the in the areas where competition is tough for the defense work. You're going to hurt some lawyers.
Representative Dix.
Seals has no position on 325?
No, we do.
You're against it?
No, we're against the removal of the third-party practice. Yeah.
Why?
Why? Yeah, no, listen, go ahead.
No, I think this, you know, I would, again, in talking with a lot of our people, respectfully disagree with Mr. Gonzo in the sense that, sure, you can argue on one side that it will complicate some cases, make them more involved, bring more people into it, and maybe make that case take longer. On the other side of the coin, if you have a case of indemnity or contribution, if you can't bring everybody into the action who ought to be there to resolve it in one lawsuit, you're only forcing the situation into a multiplicity of lawsuits. In other words, as Mr. Gonzo said, we settle the case between us, and then if the defendant thinks somebody else is responsible, we go out and sue for contribution. Well, I think the theory behind the third-party practice is get it all done in one action. The other reason that we opposed Senate Bill 325 in conjunction with what came out of the Senate in 323 relating to joint and several liability was this, that under joint and several liability, with the changes that are proposed, and we'll hopefully get to that shortly this evening, the majority bill, as you know, that came out of the Senate would say that for non-economic damages, liability hereafter would be several only. For non-economic, there'd be a threshold below which a minimally responsible defendant would be severally liable only and not jointly. The majority bill said below 10%. The minority report said below 20%. The purpose of that was to let out, or at least to limit the responsibility of the minimally responsible at-fault defendant, but otherwise hold that defendant in jointly and severally liable for economic damages. Now, if you do away with third-party practice, it's conceivable that the smart plaintiff, in looking at, for instance, a G.I. Joe's type case, where you have somebody who has stolen guns and ammunition from a retail store, committed a crime, but obviously is judgment proof, has no money whatsoever, then a smart plaintiff in that case would sue only G.I. Joe's and not join the individual who actually perpetrated and caused the final crime. Why? Well, to avoid having any apportionment of damages be made between that individual and the retail store. Under third-party practice, a defendant who feels that an individual ought to be joined and brought into the whole picture can join that individual as a third-party defendant, and you'd have everybody in the same action among whom you could apportion damages. Without third-party practice, the G.I. Joe store could not bring in the criminal who ripped them off and who actually caused the ultimate crime, and there wouldn't be anybody to apportion damages, and they'd get stuck for whatever amount the jury wanted to award. That was our concern, that if in conjunction with the changes of 323, you did away with third-party practice, you'd pretty well negate any hoped-for gains in joint several liability.
The smart plaintiff's lawyer isn't going to have an empty chair sitting beside the defendant, so that the defendant is in there can put the blame all on the empty chair. The smart plaintiff's lawyer does not do it that way. Right, Mr. Springer? But no, it's a subterfuge that just costs more money and takes you longer to get to trial. And if there is a right to indemnity or contribution, first thing is you got 47% of the cases being won by the defendant, so that makes these cross-claims are third-party complaints all moot in 47% of the cases. And if they really, truly have a case, I've seen many cases where a defendant has been sued and the defendant tenders the complaint to somebody else. That's usually in the case of products liability, where the retailer is sued and not the manufacturer. They tender it, and the manufacturer will come in and defend the retailer at his cost, because he'd rather see the retailer being sued than big General Motors or whatever it is, and is taken care of in that respect. If for some reason the plaintiff's lawyer is foolish enough not to join the manufacturer, or there are some cases where you just don't know who the manufacturer is on fungible goods, like a nail or a hammer or that type of thing. But I submit to you, it'd save a lot of money, and I just really, I can see why. Then there's lawyers that just truly like to make a big production out of everything they do, but we just can't afford it anymore.
Representative Handler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gronzo, I've heard about you, and I remember the watching on TV in the early 70s, that senator, and I've always been wary of somebody that introduces themselves as a country lawyer ever since I watched that. But I think my question would be directed to Mr. Lombard. Under our law nowadays, as it exists, somebody is only, a defendant would only be severally liable if that defendant is found less negligent than the person that brings the claim. That's existing law now, isn't it?
That's correct.
Just so I understood that, and I'm not sure that's been made clear.
No, I simply wanted to put it in response to Representative Dick's question in the context of what came over to you in Senate Bill 323. In other words, you can't really divorce the concepts in 323 from what you're trying to do in 325.
Under joint and several liability, isn't it true that each defendant need be a material contributing cause? Now, I'm not talking about fault percentage, but to be held in, don't they need to be material factor in the causation chain? Isn't that a part of already an existing part of the law of the state?
They have to be a causal factor, but in terms of materiality, that's really a relative term. I've seen special verdicts from juries that have found, when they've sat down and decided to apportion fault, and said, "Well,
wait a minute. Now, if I understand the law, causation and fault are two separate concepts.
I understand. I'm not arguing causation, but what I'm arguing is that you use the term materially, and I'm saying that really is relative in terms of however you're using it. When I speak of a minimally responsible defendant, I'm speaking of the situation where a jury says, yes, that any number of multiple defendants have responsibility for the plaintiff's injuries, but we find defendant A only 10% at fault and defendant B 90% at fault.
My question of you is, though, isn't it true before any jury ever reaches that question that they must find any defendant that they apportion fault to a causative in some material way?
Yes.
Of the person who's making the claims damages.
So I say a causal relationship has to exist.
Yeah, and that I don't think has been made clear to this committee, because causation and negligence are often confused. Causation and fault are often confused.
Well, Representative Henry, we, of course, haven't had an opportunity yet to discuss with you joint and several liability. I do have another witness here who's prepared to, you know, talk about that.
Well, yeah, and Kip, you're right. I'm done.
Okay.
Thank you.
Before we excuse Mr. Gronzo to have a chance to enjoy Salem and dinner this evening, are there any further questions? Representative Dix?
No questions.
Representative Phillips?
I just want to say
enjoyed your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gronzo. Kip?
Can I go right in then?
Okay. I think this has been our introduction.
I guess it has, yeah. I've asked Chris Kitchell down from Portland to talk on joint and several liability. I will hand out to you now the what we've had put into LC draft form, the SEAL's proposed amendments to joint and several. I would simply say this about those amendments, as I think I indicated a few minutes ago, the bill that came over to you from the Senate would say that for non-economic damages, there would be several liability only. For economic damages, there would be a threshold level below which the liability would be several only. The majority report set that threshold level at below 10%. The minority report set that threshold level at below 20%. The minority report also added the provision that in apportioning fault, the jury must also take into consideration any fault of third-party defendants. With that, I'll turn it over to Mrs. Kitchell to talk on the issue.
Welcome.
Hi, I'm Chris Kitchell. I'm an attorney with the law firm Stoll Reeves, Foley, Frazier & Wise. I do primarily defense work. I am a litigator.